Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, has democracy become like fast food? We'll discuss slow democracy. Then on the Scholar Circle, historically, corporations were required to have a public purpose in order to exist. They were dissolved once they achieved that purpose. How did we get to where we are today? And what does it mean for democracy? Should democracy slow down? Is it too much like fast food? Our next guest argues that it is. Susan Clark is co-author of Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home. Welcome, Susan Clark.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Let's start with your basic concept, your idea of slow democracy, that perhaps moving too fast, you lose some aspects of democracy.
That's right. We're taking the inspiration from the slow food movement, you know, which I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of, which argues that fast food symbolizes a lot of what's wrong with the world today. You know, in the name of efficiency, we've kind of centralized and overprocessed what's worthwhile out of our lives. And so slow food argues that we should understand our agricultural systems and our connection to place and to natural world. And in that same way, with slow democracy, we're arguing that we should reconnect with our decision-making and to place and to our local democracy, and that we'll make better informed, more sustainable decisions using that local knowledge.
A couple of arguments that you make in here. One is that localization argument, and the other is decentralization. What are the limitations that you see?
Well, I think that many policymakers, whether mindfully or simply out of neglect, have siphoned a lot of power and deliberative democratic opportunities away from communities. And this is oftentimes based on sort of that Industrial Revolution idea of efficiency and how helpful it is to centralize things for economies of scale. And all of these decisions, I think, are made with good intention and goodwill. But we've lost a lot of the benefits of community democracy. And, you know, we see this, for example, in the planning world. In the 1960s, we saw a lot of urban renewal where they tore down, you know, inner-city neighborhoods, but without consulting the people in those neighborhoods, and oftentimes really destroyed healthy social fabric, community fabric. And, you know, we see it sometimes in rural school consolidation, where we close small schools sometimes without acknowledging or even understanding what happens to a community that loses its school as a gathering place or as a civic training ground for parents, as an entryway for personal leadership. So some of these elements of community, we think of them sometimes as old-fashioned, but in fact, there are some new studies that show that a strong community really has a powerful impact on many aspects of our future.
So the reason I was asking about the limitation aspect of it is it seems there are some things that really operate well on the local decision-making level and some things that maybe should be given to a central entity.
Absolutely, yes. And we have a chapter in our book where we talk, for example, about the civil rights movement, which, you know, in many ways began at the local level, but really had to have a national entity come in to enforce some of the decisions that were being made by society but were being resisted at the community level. And we have a few other examples in history that really show that there's a time and a place for centralized democracy. But what we're worried about is that the pendulum has swung a little too far in terms of centralized decision-making and also in terms of privatizing many of our democratic decision-making processes and some of the things that we ask our government or our commons to care for.
Now, of course, privatization takes the decision-making completely out of the public hands. One of the questions that comes up among political scientists and political theories deals with, like here in the U.S., people deal with having to make a lot of democratic decisions and so many democratic decisions they couldn't possibly do it without having a full-time job as a democratic decision-maker. So, for example, they have to decide their school board members, their county council people, their city council people, their state representative, their state senator, their state governor, their congressperson, their federal senator, the president, the water district, the judges, even here a radio station board, and all of the ballot propositions.
Sure. And there are places that, you know, Switzerland, for example, has also many times they're voting 3 and 4 times a year on multiple ballot measures. And, you know, they have democracy fatigue that they complain about. It's, I think, relatively rare in terms of, you know, when you ask people why they're pulling back from, you know, how do they feel about their government, how do they feel about democracy, most of the time what we hear is people who feel disempowered and disenfranchised as opposed to being asked too many things. And a lot of sadness, I think, the statistics show, about people's loss of faith in government. I think one of the key elements of slow democracy is that the decisions that we do take time to make, to make sure that that's a quality decision-making process, rather than, for example, maybe asking me to pick between two potential water board members. Maybe a better use of my time would be every few years to pull me in to a conversation at the beginning of a policymaking process about water, where I'm able to really shape and guide some of the values that go into the decision-making process that then my elected officials will take on. Many times when people say, I don't have time for democracy, what I hear is, I hear that as a challenge. I hear that as, my time is precious. Make it worth my time to be part of democracy. And that doesn't mean give me yet more boring hearings to go to and to maybe offer my opinion at, but offer me an inclusive, truly deliberative, and empowered process where I can make a difference in something that matters to me. And that's where we really see people really shine.
Well, let's talk about some of these. You had some great examples, and perhaps we can just go through some of them and talk about how they are developing. Let's move to Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Portsmouth is a wonderful story, and it's this is a little city of about 20,000 people right on the border of New Hampshire and Maine. They had a big employer there about 20 years ago, the Pease Air Force Base. But that Air Force Base shut down. They lost about, 4,000 military personnel, another 2,400 related jobs. And, we all know what it feels like to have, a displaced economy. But there was sort of insult to injury there in Portsmouth because they ended up with badly skewed elementary schools, two elementary schools that were very under-enrolled and one that was just bursting at the seams. And it was a political hot potato. I think, as many people know about redistricting and those kinds of questions, very tricky to move kids, and parents were very resistant. So it just got pushed down the road year after year for 10 years. There were kids being taught in the hallways and, teachers, with broom closets for offices. So finally, the school board and superintendent got innovative and took a chance on something called study circles, which is a process put up by the Everyday Democracy Group, which is a wonderful, inclusive, deliberative, empowered, we call it slow democracy, kind of process. And they started really by beating the bushes, making sure that they had good participation from all across the different schools, all the different neighborhoods. And started with a small group process, so broke up into small conversational groups where they could really build trust and start to understand where each other were coming from. And they agreed to meet for over the series of, I think it was 5 or 6 meetings, and rotated among the 3 schools, so they really got good information on the ground. And because of those conversations and really good on-the-ground research, they were able to, rather than just talk about, my answer is best and here's what I think we should do, talk about the underlying values. And that's it's the slow part of slow democracy, but it's what really builds the best new creative answers. They came up with answers that the school board hadn't even considered. Their recommendations were scooped up by the school board, and in the end, after 10 years of frustration, the school board proposed, it was about $2 million at that point, I think, in facility improvements, which received broad support and were approved by the community. And the proposal was so well informed by the citizens that it would affect that it just made a lot of sense on the ground. There were only 65 students who had to switch schools. So I think one of the most exciting things about Portsmouth is that they have really gone on to use this kind of study circle, inclusive, deliberative, empowered process over and over again over the years. They've used it to create a community sustainability plan. They've used it in their master planning process. They've used it in multiple issues, and it's really changed the way the town does their work.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Susan Clark about her new book, Slow Democracy: Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home. Are there other cities that you think are doing that well, larger ones?
Sure. Austin, Texas, has some wonderful, very much interested in dialogue and deliberation, and that's a much bigger city. But they are able to use, for example, neighborhood community centers to get input on their master planning process by using something they've created called Meeting in a Box, where they map out what they would like people to talk about, and then use the social capital that exists right there in those neighborhoods and have the meetings in pre-existing groups. And they use the process and ask the questions that the city would love to have citizens' answers on, and then feed those back in to the community planning process.
Now, how does the factor of NIMBYism, not in my backyardism, affect something like this?
Well, it's very important, obviously. The thing that deliberation does, and we define that pretty rigorously, it doesn't just mean talking. It means a respectful interaction, oftentimes facilitated, where you really are backing away from predetermined decisions, and rather than, you know, trying to argue about A versus B, you're kind of co-creating C, if you can imagine. So people are able to get away from the NIMBY stance that they may have come to the meeting with, and really explore the common values that they have with other people in the room. And that's what happened in Portsmouth. I think many, many people came to those meetings knowing exactly what they thought should happen. But they weren't asked, what do you think should happen? Instead, they were asked, well, what are some of the values that the school board needs to consider when we're making this decision? And so they backed away from those immediate decisions, and that's the new brain studies that are coming out are showing that that's when we can find the creative solutions and get away from some of that gridlock that we've unfortunately gotten so used to these days.
Let's talk about some of the ways in which these creative processes work. Some examples that you used were really creative, like theater and this group called Apathy is Boring.
Sure, absolutely. You know, we really ask people to think of government as a we and not a they. And that's pretty hard for a lot of people who are used to, many people I talk with just say politics is something I don't do. They've really just gotten so burned out on that kind of decision making. But if we can, you know, really think about it as we the people, we can start to come up with better solutions that way. And I think it was the California city manager who said that too often we're looking at government as if it's a vending machine, and we should just put our money in one end and the services come out the other, and if it doesn't work, we kick it. Well, that's not what the founders had in mind. So, you know, with slow democracy, we're saying no drive-through democracy, you know, needs to be an inclusive deliberative process that really, you know, we need to leave a little time to carry it out. And it should, of course, wield power. You know, one of the benefits that these, in particular, some new studies on deliberation, one of them in deliberation in juries, has shown that's very exciting to me is that when we get involved in decision-making, local decision-making that is truly deliberative, we come away changed, and it creates a virtuous spiral within the community. For example, with the jury system, you know, regular people off the street that for a few days or weeks out of their lives, you know, are making very empowered binding judgments as part of the democratic system. These remarkable new studies show jury service raises voting rates. So if I am a juror, I am likely to go on for the rest of my life to vote more regularly. It often increases political activity. It often improves self-confidence just in your own political abilities. People are likely to get more involved in community groups, follow public issues in the news more, and many people say that their faith in their fellow citizens is increased, all because of these kinds of small-scale deliberations. So these are the kinds of processes that can really reweave our democratic fabric.
How is technology facilitating deliberative democracy?
Absolutely. And you know, technology is a tool, like any other tool. You can use a hammer to build things or you can use a hammer to destroy things. And there are some wonderful new technologies that allow people, not only, of course, we all know that the Internet allows us to organize ourselves better, inform ourselves better. We're able to become organized at the at network and whatnot. But also, there's software that allow us to actually hold online deliberations so that with people who may not be able to come to a meeting or be in the room. There are also some wonderful, here in Vermont we have something called Front Porch Forum. In Minnesota they have eDemocracy. These are listserv types of communications that are very specifically neighborhood-based. They aren't as big as, you know, Facebook or anything like that, but they're intended to connect neighbor with neighbor on neighborly things. Things like, you know, has anybody seen my lost cat? Or I need to borrow a canoe. Or would anybody, you know, need some new snow tires? those kinds of communications. But also at the same time, as I'm reading through my daily digest, did you know there's a meeting tonight at the Planning Commission? And, here's a way that you can feed your opinions into the school board. So really tend to, these are technologies that don't keep us in front of our computers. They get us out talking to our neighbors.
When you have these deliberations, whether they are online or in a living room conversation, how does one keep them from spiraling out into the ugly politics that we see?
Isn't that a great question? And I know the people who have created Front Porch Forum have wrestled with that problem quite a bit. One of the most important, helpful ways, especially at a community level, is anonymity is discouraged. And in fact, in some of these, it's not allowed. So it's the same thing that happens here in New England when we have a town meeting. I'm likely to be more civil with my neighbor if I'm speaking with them face-to-face. And they know that, next week, they might be driving by as my car is in a snowbank. You know, I'm going to hope that they're going to pull me out. So there's a certain neighborliness that, a level of civility that is encouraged by that lack of anonymity. But a good facilitator also goes a long way, because facilitators have a way of keeping us on track and keeping us focused on not on the personalities, but on the problem at hand.
Even people who are very close sometimes break down into very ugly dialogue instead of deliberation.
It happens. It definitely happens. But we have especially when issues are well-framed and it's clear that we're moving toward an empowered decision-making end, it's much more likely, and we see this again and again in these processes, that we're able to get back on track again. Those three elements, inclusion, deliberation, and power, they really work together very well. They weave in and out of each other very well and allow us to really move forward.
Susan Clark, co-author of Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. And people can find us at slowdemocracy.org.
Thank you so much. Once upon a time, corporations were required to have a public purpose to operate in the United States. How did the system become what it is today? Next on the Scholar Circle. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. Back in the late 18th century, corporations were required to have a public purpose. Then they were dissolved once they completed that purpose. Today's corporate model is quite different, where the purpose is profit alone. And alongside these changes, the corporation's power has grown immensely. How did we get here, and what is the effect on important matters like democracy? We are joined by three experts. Richard Abrams is a professor of history at University of California at Berkeley and the author of America Transformed, 60 Years of Revolutionary Change, 1941 to 2001. Paul Pearson is also with us. He's a professor of political science at University of California at Berkeley. He has written numerous books, including Winner Take All Politics, the latest, as well as Off Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. We also have with us Scott Bowman. Scott Bowman is the chair of the political science department at Cal State University in Los Angeles, and he is the author of The Modern Corporation and American Political Thought, Law, Power, and Ideology. Richard Abrams, you and I first met when I worked in the California legislature, and you came and testified talking about the history of corporate power and how that affected American politics, starting really back in this time when corporations were created to serve a public purpose and then dissolved. And now it's evolved into something else. Talk about how this has evolved and how it relates to corporate law and the position of American corporations in American politics now.
You go back to the beginnings, which we're talking about, the late 18th and early 19th century. A corporation as a form of business organization, which is a creature of the state, and that's something one should always remember.
Clarify what you mean by creature of the state.
Corporation doesn't exist except when, by legislative authority, it is given a charter. Well, it used to be to do some very specific things. And the point that you're making about the corporation as having originally been serving public purpose is that the state would authorize, franchise a group of business people for the purpose of mobilizing capital, giving certain protection to the owners of the firm, of the entity, in order to encourage investment in a particular function that has public usefulness for which private enterprise by itself was not likely to have the resources, and government in particular. In the 19th century, when there were very few sources of revenue, the government did not have the resources to achieve. So your original corporations tended to have to do with public utility kind of things, building of bridges, of roads, and eventually getting into banks and into mining facilities. And that was because there were not enough government resources to do that sort of thing by itself. So they franchised private enterprises to mobilize capital for that kind of purpose. The idea of it as serving a public function was specified usually in the charters. That is, the charters specifically said what exactly the business entity was supposed to be doing. But as the 19th century went on, and the major function and the major purpose of public policy was to encourage economic growth, then gradually the corporations came to be justified not solely on a basis of serving a public function, but simply to be making money, to be profitable, so that they could carry on and contribute, most important, contribute to economic growth in general. And over time, by the end of the 19th century, the requirement that the charter hold the corporation to some specific purposes tended to disappear. Its main function, as Friedman liked to say, was to make money, was to be profitable. That's what it was there for, and in that way contributed to the general welfare. And you get into the 20th century, and by the early 20th century, people are worried about the enormous amount of money that is, in fact, being mobilized by these entities, particularly as they go public, which is to say that they can advertise and sell portions, parcels of their ownership to the general public on a stock, what we call a stock exchange. And so there was a concern about how that might influence politics and diminish democracy, the democratic process. So a number of pieces of legislation were put into effect, including in 1907, limitations on how much money a corporation, or in fact banning the use of corporate funds for election purposes. In effect, that was what was completely nullified by the most recent Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, where it said a corporation is a person and therefore can't be deprived of First Amendment free speech rights.
Maybe that's the perfect place to bring in Scott Bowman, because Scott Bowman, you have looked at this through the eyes of the courts as well as legislation and lobbying, and you and I have spoken over 15 years or something about these matters. The personhood issue is one of the big cases. Why don't you talk about this evolution that you've seen in the court and kind of the key cases that you think have led to Citizens United?
Well, recently the Supreme Court acknowledged that the corporation, in effect, is a person for purposes of First Amendment rights. But before this, going back to the Bilotti case in 1978, the court had extended such rights really to the corporation for purposes of independent expenditures in elections that did not go to candidates but were just spent during the election cycle itself. It never actually squarely addressed the issue of whether the corporation was a person for First Amendment purposes. Most people aren't aware of the fact that the corporation has had First Amendment rights for some time now. It's this more recent case that brought it to the fore precisely because it struck down a case, the Austin case, which was decided in 1990, that limited the corporation's ability to spend directly in candidate elections. I guess I should clarify what's going on here, because the election law, the Federal Election Campaign Act, which gave rise to all of this law, is actually fairly complex as interpreted by the courts. And there's a basic distinction that was established in the Buckley case in 1976, and that is that the court imposed restrictions on contributions to candidates, which are still in place, and that applies to contributions from individuals, corporations, and unions. On the other hand, it did not impose the same restrictions on independent expenditures at that time, because expenditures were deemed not to have a corrupting influence on elections, as were direct contributions. That's always been a controversial distinction, and many members of the court never fully agreed with that distinction. What happens in Austin case is that the court imposes, or upholds rather, a restriction in Michigan law that prevented corporations and unions from contributing to candidates in candidate elections as expenditures, not contributions. What happened in the most recent case, Citizens United, is that Austin was overturned. So what that amounts to is that now corporations and unions are free to spend as much as they want in candidate elections, although they're still not allowed to make contributions beyond the federally prescribed limitations. But it doesn't really matter about that limitation anymore, because they can funnel money in the millions to any candidate they want through various organizations. And that's what's happened with that, is that, of course, much of this is undisclosed, and in the future, millions and millions of dollars will be spent on candidate elections, and for some people, it will completely subvert the purpose of the election reform, precisely because there will be sort of an unequal distribution of income or resources in candidate races. So that's really the backdrop of the more recent changes, and there have been some indications that already that's been the case in the 2010 election cycle.
You've mentioned two things that I think are important to tie in now for our audience. One is really the effect that we're seeing on equality, and the other is the effect that we're seeing on democracy as a result of this kind of evolution that's been going on over the past couple of centuries. And as I understand from all of your work, that it's really accelerated over the last 50 years, and especially the last probably 35, 40 years, this kind of erosion of democracy and erosion of equality. Paul Pearson, I think we should bring you in on this to kind of bring this all together. Now, Scott Bowman, you mentioned the thing about labor unions and corporations both being able to spend, but labor unions have been, through various legislative processes, really weakened. So, Paul Pearson, pull this all together for us.
It's a huge topic, so I'm not sure I can pull it all together, but just to add a few points, I do think that in many ways the Citizens United decision, as dramatic as it is more a symptom of a much broader transformation that's taking place than in itself a fundamental shift in the politics. Because, as you were saying, Maria, there has been over the last, I would say since the late 70s, mid to late 70s, there's been a dramatic shift in the balance of political power and organized presence in American politics in favor of the affluent and business in particular. And Citizens United is just one symptom of that that comes at the end of a long process, which has involved both, as you mentioned, increasing inequality, but an increasing prominence of the role of business in American politics. You could tell a story about Citizens United that would link to that by saying, well, why is the Supreme Court making that kind of decision? Well, part of the reason is because over the last 20 or 30 years, conservatives have put enormous energy into trying to refashion the Supreme Court in directions that are going to be more favorable to business interests. There's been some interesting research on this lately showing that the Supreme Court has been getting much more conservative on economic issues, and it's also been paying much more attention to economic issues. And, of course, it's mostly Republican appointees who have been advancing that agenda, though they've been strongly encouraged by a number of organized groups that have tried to really push the legal process in this direction. The Chamber of Commerce in particular has been very active on these issues. So that's one example of what I think you would see if you looked at a lot of different aspects of American politics over the last 30 years, whether it's the courts or the legislature or regulatory agencies or the media. You would see a much more aggressive push in favor of the interests of the most organized parts of American business.
Paul Pearson, you in your book have actually broken out how bad the inequality has become. Can you give us a sense of what the numbers tell us?
I should just mention my co-author, Jacob Hacker. We published a book last fall called Winner Take All Politics. And the change in inequality, which is central to what we're looking at, is stunning over the last 30 years. There's been a more than doubling of the income share of the top 1%. There's been a more than quadrupling of the income share of the top 10th of 1%, the truly wealthy in American society. And while economists often suggest that this is just a result of globalization or technology or natural economic forces, we argue in the book that there's a lot of evidence to suggest that American politics has played a really critical role in bringing this about. And one piece of evidence suggesting that that's the case is the fact that you don't see the same kind of incredible concentration of income taking place in most other successful economies, most other affluent democracies. There's something quite distinctive going on in the United States, and politics is a big part of that.
Now, you mentioned the Chamber of Commerce being a big part of this. Scott Bowman, you've looked very hard at another one of the organizations, the Economic Roundtable. Tell us about this one.
It's the Business Roundtable. Before I talk about that, I just want to add to what Paul said. And there's a recent study done by the Constitutional Accountability Center, and it shows that on the Roberts Court, 68% of the time, when the chamber is arguing a case, it has won. And it compares that to the Burger Court, and the numbers are striking. Only 46% of the time did the chamber win when its case is before the court. That supports what he's suggesting. And it's clear that the justices have been picked for their political views as well, and, I mean, their pro-business views. Now, as far as the Business Roundtable goes, this is an organization that was formed in the early 70s in response to the rising tide of social legislation, and it was really originally formed out of groups, a couple of different groups that were going after labor. It was really kind of a movement afoot in the corporate community. But the Business Roundtable developed into a much more comprehensive organization, and it's really stunning in its effect. It consists of about the top 200 CEOs in the United States, and I guess they elect a new chairman every 2 or 3 years. And it is divided into issue-oriented task force that actually lobby senators and representatives. So it's actually CEOs that are doing the lobbying. But even more significant is the fact that the CEO, rather the chair of the roundtable himself, has access to the White House on a regular basis. The last 30 or 40 years has been what some analysts refer to as a political mobilization of business, has led to an increasing influence of large corporations through direct political activity, particularly lobbying. And this kind of lobbying, I think, is even more impressive than just the amount of money that's spent, because it's really about access. And just to give you an example, the chair of the roundtable wrote something or released several messages in the press being highly critical of Obama's policies on a variety of fronts. Within a matter of months, the Obama administration has been, as we've seen, courting the Chamber of Commerce, which is another one of the large corporate lobbies, and responded to the chair and has begun to moderate its policies in basically every area that the Business Roundtable has criticized. It's not a coincidence. Of course, you could argue that Obama's doing this to move to the center for electoral purposes, but it's very clear that the roundtable has tremendous influence.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Richard Abrams, Paul Pearson, Scott Bowman about how corporations were required to have a public purpose to operate in the United States. How did the system become what it is today? And Richard Abrams, let's bring you back in. One of the things you've looked at is kind of the result of this on basic public policies and also on the public tax structure and how much the shift in tax laws and the burden of financing public goods has occurred as a result of this kind of political activity in the courts. Talk to us about what that result has been.
I think that you can't legitimately talk about a Reagan revolution although the Business Roundtable was organized in the early 1970s, its avowed purpose was, in fact, to have the leaders of business corporations use their influence in their own political environments, considering that by the 1970s, the conglomerate movement had moved many of these firms into a multitude of different industries. That meant that in many different venues, the corporate leaders would devote their energies to influencing political or policy decisions. Now, that was really new by that time because, for the most part, CEOs did not themselves directly get involved in politics. They left that to lobbyists whom they hired. I'm not saying they weren't interested in political and policy outcomes, but they did not personally get so involved in it as they began to do in the early 1970s. So you could say there's already a transformation that's taken place in which corporate America has become self-consciously and deliberately involved in policymaking to the extent of their power, which is not inconsiderable. The Reagan Revolution, though, included this business about the changes in the Supreme Court. It's interesting that most of the biographers of Reagan and of the Reagan administration, the Reagan administration was among the first, at least in the 20th century, to specifically have a test, an ideological test for those who were going to be appointed to the federal courts, not just the Supreme Court, but the appellate courts as well. And so you had candidates who were being interviewed specifically about their political and their ideological interests. Now, one looks back at the appointments to courts. Of course, presidents always wanted to appoint somebody who might be sympathetic to their political outlooks. And that was always true. But at the same time, they did not make it so much of a party issue, and certainly not even of an ideological one. So you have, for example, Herbert Hoover appoints Cardoza, who was a Democrat, to the court on the grounds that he was the best person that most of people in the business and the profession thought would be was available. Eisenhower appoints another very important Democrat, Brennan, to the court, and he specifically wanted a Democrat on the court. There was, in other words, this sense of fairness that was attached to the appointments. The Reagan administration is really quite different than that. Although Nixon, to some degree, had already altered the groundwork on that, the Reagan administration is the real change, and that has persisted for the last 30 years. So, yes, that's been an important part of the swing to the right and toward big businesses' interests, not just businesses' interests, but big businesses' interests.
One of the reasons why I think it is so important is because it's become the rhetoric of the right, especially with the Tea Party movement, this anti-taxation thing, without understanding what has actually happened with the public financing.
Well, I think that there's a much broader reason for the appeal of the tax issue to ordinary Americans, why they seem to be beguiled by the notion of tax cuts. And I think there's been a very dramatic sea change in American attitudes, in the American mentality, which I do attribute to two things. One is the, of course, shift in the development of American economic growth in the 1970s, where in the immediate post-war decades, you had tremendous economic growth and a tremendous spread in affluence in the country, including a reduction in inequality. And then you have the 1970s, which all of a sudden, things changed. And the country went into stagflation, and economic opportunity seemed to be shrinking exactly at the time that the baby boomers are coming of age and flooding into politics, into the economic arena, into business, and into education. It's exactly that time. They're coming off their own experience of having a pretty good life and looking forward to still a better life in the future. But now what they're facing is tremendous competition from their cohorts, at a time when the economic environment has turned sour. And in addition, they now have to face competition from those groups in the United States that had been severely discriminated against, including women and minorities. They're now vying for exactly the same kind of posts as the white males of the baby boomers. And so you have now an environment that indeed gives rise to the dubbing of the 1970s as the me decade. And you have now, instead of the kind of generosity that characterized the previous two or three decades, now what you have is a very sour, very self-oriented, me-first kind of generation, and I think that's one of the things that has persisted.
This is Paul Pearson. Could I just jump in on this one point?
Please.
Because I guess I would just want to emphasize in contrast with some of those last comments that I do not think that public opinion is the main thing that's driving this at all. There, as you were saying, Maria, there's been a sharp shift in tax policy, which has really favored those at the very top of the income distribution. There's research by one of my Berkeley colleagues, Emmanuel Saez, that shows that over the last 30 years, the real tax rates that most Americans pay at the federal level have stayed very stable. The only group that they've really changed dramatically for are those people in the top 1% of the income distribution, and especially those towards the top of that very top group. And for them, the rates that they pay in taxes have dropped really dramatically, even as their wealth and their incomes have gone up dramatically. So it's a really astonishing change. There's nothing in public opinion data, which I've studied very carefully on this issue, there is nothing to suggest that that is the outcome that the public favors. You know, even if you look at the fight over the extension of the Bush tax cuts, where the question was, are we going to extend all the Bush tax cuts or just those for the bottom 98% of the income distribution? And, of course, ultimately Congress and the president agreed to extend them all, including, you know, huge tax breaks for people at the top of the income distribution. And the polling data was very clear while that debate was going on. Most Americans favored not extending the tax cuts for people at the top of the income distribution, and yet there was bipartisan agreement to do it anyway. So I don't believe that the main reason we're getting growing inequality and getting a growing business heft in American society and American politics is because public opinion shifted.
I don't think you're actually saying two different things in reality. And I remember, Richard Abrams, your testimony at the California State Senate where you talked about not just the wealthy taxes being reduced, but the corporate taxes being reduced, and now everything turning into fees. So now there are fees on everything, museums and zoos and parks, et cetera. So I think that what he's referencing is not that public opinion supports less taxes for the rich so much as that they don't understand it to that degree and are angry about just having to share the pot with all these other groups. Is that correct, Richard Abrams?
Yes, I'm not really disputing Mr. Pearson's argument about the, in some ways, the structural reasons for the success of the anti-tax forces and the pro-corporation forces in Congress. I think that all those, I buy all of that. I'm grateful for the kind of research that Pearson has done. But what I am saying is that there has been a shift in mentality, which makes it possible for people to have maybe even contradictory views. Polls, you know, will lead you to all sorts of things. Yes, let's cut taxes, but let's not cut my services. Let's cut subsidies, but don't cut the subsidies for me. One has to understand that when put to the test with referenda, for example, you have such things as Proposition 13 in 1978 in California, which effectively has wrecked public services in California, and then that had an epidemic effect around the country. People don't like taxes, but they don't like government, and there's a whole litany of reasons for that, which I could go into, but I wouldn't have.
There are two things I'd like to get into this. One is that part of the effort, Scott Bowman, I think this was partly your work, was when the Business Roundtable organized, part of it was to change public opinion. And I'm wondering if perhaps this move in the mass media from more neutral public affairs and news programs to a very ideological kind of programming could be connected to this concerted effort by organized corporate interests. Does that seem logical?
I'm not sure that was really a plan, so to speak, but I think it's a function of the merger move more than anything else. It's the concentration of media that's given rise to relatively few companies that control vast conglomerates. And I think
I think the change in regulation, if you think about it, because they lifted the fairness doctrine.
Well, the Fairness Doctrine died a long time ago, but the real regulatory change came in 1996. But that was preceded by dramatic changes in mergers that really began with the Carter administration. But since 1996, media mergers have just completely gone off the charts in terms of size and number. And by leading to increasing concentration and fewer entities that actually provide the news, we no longer have that diversity of opinion that we might have had in the past. Now, there's a lot of arguments here that the Internet has actually provides diversity in a variety of ways, but when you're talking about the polarization of media in terms of political views, you can point to Fox News, for example, as actually politicizing news content to a large extent. And, of course, other entities are responding as well to that. So I think that has a lot to do with concentration in media. And, of course, the political role of business has something to do with it. But I think it's more about corporate ownership at this point. I would add that that's the other major aspect. When we're talking about corporations and American democracy and politics, besides lobbying, besides campaign contributions, it's the effect on media, media's effect on politics, and the fact that public debate in some ways has been changed dramatically by corporate control.
And that would bring me to really a very, very key question. And Paul Pierce, I'm going to bring you in first. And that is, you know, there's a lot of talk about reform, about trying to restore democratic ideals and practices and to shrink the inequality that we're seeing. And people have talked about a lot of different ways to get there. One is labor movements, trying to reinvigorate labor. One is focusing on the legal aspect of it, like personhood, revocation of charters. Some say, no, we just need to go and regulate better. So when you think about restoring democratic ideals, political participation, political power, and equality, what would you say would be the most effective way to focus?
Well, Jacob and I actually give a pretty emphatic answer to that question in the book, which is that the critical thing to focus on is political organization. We think that an awful lot follows from that. And in some ways, that may be a way to explain at least the difference in emphasis between my comments before about public opinion and what Professor Abrams said, much of which I agree with. You know, there certainly is a lot of middle-class frustration and anger out there, quite understandably, given the economic developments of the last few decades, really, and how hard things have been for the middle class. The question is what to do with that anger and frustration and how to direct it. And this is where I think political organization becomes so crucial, and where conservatives and their business allies, I think, have been enormously successful in using their organizational advantages to channel that frustration in directions that are advantageous to them. And we see that today. So if you look at the events of the last 2 years, it's really quite astonishing to see how an economic crisis that was generated by absolutely scandalous practices being followed in the financial industry that enriched a very small circle of people at the expense of everyone else led to a terrible economic downturn and really widespread unemployment that we were still struggling with. And somehow this is now being channeled into an aggressive effort to cut government programs and, you know, identifying as the main scapegoats public sector workers. And there is just no evidence at all to suggest that the status of these workers has much at all to do with the circumstances that state governments are facing. So it's a tremendously clear example of how organizational resources are being used to push an agenda that will advantage certain economic interests in the United States at the expense of others.
When you say political organization, what should be the focus?
I think at the moment that defending unions is absolutely crucial. You know, it is not an accident that conservatives are using their recent electoral victories to launch an aggressive attack on public sector unions. For them, it's a double whammy, right? It both gives them a scapegoat that distracts attention from the real problems in American politics and the American economy, and it gives them a chance to increase their power at the expense of the only, you know, substantial group that brings resources to bear in defense of middle class and working class interests on economic issues in American politics. So, you know, unions have been, you know, and I don't want to say that unions never do anything wrong, because of course they do on occasion, and sometimes they push for things that produce narrow advantages rather than broad ones. But on every broad economic debate about how the resources of the American economy should be distributed, unions have been on the side of the vast majority of American citizens. So in the first moment, I think, you know, working to defend unions at a moment when they are really under vicious attack is crucial, and then expanding out from there to try to convince more Americans that that organizing around economic issues is absolutely critical to provide some kind of counterweight to the kinds of forces that have been dominating American politics and policy over the last couple of decades with disastrous effects for the rest of us.
Richard Abrams?
I can't disagree with anything that you said, except that I would say that you mustn't underplay the degree to which the mentality of the American public has changed. To give one example, it's on the newspaper of an unemployed former union member. I mean, in the United States, unlike in most of the other industrial countries, when you lose your job, you lose your unionship membership. He was a union member in a company that either dissolved or at any rate downsized, so he lost his job. And he is among those who is saying, go for it, Governor Walker. Go after these public workers because they're unionized and they're getting benefits which I don't have. Well, it's that kind of self-centered attitude that seems to me to be symptomatic of a general attitude in the country. What they might have to surrender so that other people might prosper. And even though the first part of that doesn't always apply, they don't like seeing other people prosper when they're not prospering. That's a very different attitude from what existed more than 30 years ago.
Richard Abrams, if labor unions today were strengthened and they had political power like they might have once upon a time, what would be the key issue or issues you think they should focus on that would be structural issues that could impact this democracy and economic situation?
I don't know how to go about it. I mean, as either Paul or Bowman said earlier, I don't know that the Citizens United really makes all that much difference because corporate America has always had a great deal of power and they'd always have ways of getting around any limitations on their contributions to elections. And I think it's symbolically important because it has encouraged that sort of thing to unbelievable dimensions. But somehow or other, there has to be some kind of change in the degree to which the wealthy can buy their own legislators and buy their own court appointees, because that's basically what has been happening in the last 10 to 30 years.
Scott Bowman?
I don't have any quick solution. I was just thinking when Professor Abrams was mentioning buying legislators, it seems that we're back in the era of plutocracy, like 100 years ago, during the Progressive Era. And the big argument then was that, in fact, the corporate moguls indeed did buy their legislators, and that led, of course, to some revisions in campaign financing, among other things. But not much has changed. I mean, we've gone through periods where labor did have considerable influence, I would say, in the 60s and 70s, but since the late 70s, it's been waning consistently. The real problem here is that the base of the labor movement has shrunk. I don't know the exact percentage, but I think it's gone from around 33% of American workers to less than 12% or something like that.
I think that's right. I think in the private sector, it's something like 7.8%.
And the key here is the public sector, because of what remains of the labor movement. Its revitalization, if it's occurred at all, has occurred in the public sector. And now when this money is being channeled to go after public sector workers, it's really kind of frightening for the future of the labor movement. By the way, the amount spent since Citizens United by individuals, and much of this, I suppose, has been aimed at this sort of attempt to change, particularly in Wisconsin. Just in the last election cycle, $294 million was spent. That is an increase over $68.9 million of this type of spending, and nearly half of that was spent from just 10 groups. And among those groups are the Koch brothers, and as well as two groups formed by Karl Rove. So it's pretty clear that people are seeing the opportunity to go after labor. I think what we need to do is we need to support labor, as Paul said. We need to do whatever we can to understand that it has a much broader political agenda than simply its own narrow economic interests. That's been the case for quite some time. And we need to counteract this. I don't know, we aren't going to have any change in campaign spending in the near future, but we need to do whatever we can to try and get some kind of new legislation passed that will allow people to run for office that be able to compete with the wealthy and the corporate interests.
Paul Pearson, let me give you the last word.
It's been a great discussion. I think one thing that I would say at this point is we've seen this movie before, as the other speakers have commented. This is a long, long story, and if you go back to the end of the 19th, early 20th century, it looked in some ways like the situation that we're in now. And I think what people have to realize is that on the one hand, that means there's no easy way out. It's going to take time to turn things around, but it has been done before, and it took waves of reform over an extended period of time to create a system where there was more balance in the American economy and in American politics. I have to say, polls show, yes, there certainly are individuals who are quoted in newspaper articles who sound like the individual that Professor Abrams was talking about, who don't want to see public sector workers having, you know, opportunities that they don't have. But the polling that I've seen suggests that most are pretty sympathetic to the union position on this issue. And in Madison, you had 100,000 people rallying at the Capitol in 17-degree weather in support of those unions. But I have to say, I think that for things to turn around organizationally, unions are going to be really important, but it's going to have to reach beyond unions because their level of penetration of the economy is so slight now that, you know, other Americans are going to have to figure out other ways to come together and recognize that the middle class vision that's been so central to this country for so long is really in dire, dire need of attention and correction if we're going to get things back on a more balanced course.
Great to have you all on the air here. Paul Pearson is professor of political science at UC Berkeley and author, co-author of both Off Center, Winner Take All Politics, and Richard Abrams, professor of history at University of California, Berkeley, and author of America Transformed, and Scott Bowman, chairman of political science at Cal State Los Angeles and author of The Modern Corporation and American Political Thought, Law, Power, and Ideology. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @Armudian.